actually feel bad for him. What I saw was a minstrel show today.
But I feel like there are some serious mental health issues that he's struggling with.
Wow. Okay, I'm doing this for everybody who's watching us who turned their volume down. You can put it back up again.
Him in front of all of these white people, mostly white people, embarrassing himself and embarrassing Americans, but mostly African Americans.
But if you think you're going to get a thoughtful play-by-play and political analysis, you're not.
This is white supremacy by ventriloquism. A black mouth is moving, but white racist ideals are flowing from Kanye West's mouth.
Kanye West is what happens when Negroes don't read. And we have this now, and now Donald Trump is going to use it and pervert it, and he's going to have somebody who can stand with him and take pictures.
There's a great deal of sexism in his remarks and internalized racism in his remarks, and a great deal of ignorance.
This was an embarrassment. Kanye's mother is rolling over in her grave.
That was an assault on our White House.
You can't analyze some of that stuff that was said.
Kanye West is engaging in one of the most nefarious practices yet. A black body and brain are the warehouse for the articulation and expression of anti-black sentiments that have been chin-checked by people with far more rigorous credentials.
Donda would be embarrassed by this. She would be terribly disturbed by this. And Kanye has not been the same since his mother died.
That was crazy. That was bonkers. I mean, the things that Kanye said.
Can I go with my favorite?
Yeah.
How he talked about he had a lack of male role models in his life growing up.
Not a lot of male energy in his house.
The reason he was drawn to MAGA was because of the male.
When he put that cap on, he felt like a guy who could play catch with his
because he didn't have that opportunity, which was stunning.
He kept talking today about, I put the hat on and the hat made me feel strong and wearing a cape. He needs a father figure. He needs someone to help him and to guide him. And he needs a hug more than anything. Kanye, back away from the cameras, go get some help, and then come back and make your cake.
You're listening to the Pop and Lock Report at popandlock.net, a part of the Unshackled Network. Welcome to episode 2 of the Pop and Lock Report. I'm your host, Jack Reedy, the editor of popandlock.net. I'm joined tonight by Daniel Gibbons of Young Conservatives NSW. Say hello, Daniel.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by Lucas Rosas, who is a writer for The Unshackled and XYZ, and he's got a new piece hot off the presses.
Hello. Oh, yes, this week was my lovely little one talking about the wonder that is, Rick Morton? I keep wanting to say Rick and Morty. the wonderful writer for The Australian with the cuck face to end all possible cuck faces. We'll have a chat about him a little bit later.
So firstly, we're just going to go to, we're just going to quickly address the state of climate alarmism, given this new IPCC report on climate change has gotten climate change back in the news. I didn't want to get too far into the nuts and bolts. I mean, we could probably do a climate change episode, I guess, later that would take longer. But I just wanted to get your thoughts, Luke, as someone who's been around and been paying attention to politics since the 90s, what it's been like to go through all the stages of climate change and all of the levels of alarmism and what you think of it at this point. I haven't scrutinized the new report terribly closely, but I do find it hilarious that my friends who are sharing things about how our federal member who wouldn't have a bar of the whole Paris Agreement has previously worked for mining companies, and they ignore the fact that the head of the IPCC previously worked for ExxonMobil.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, well, when they first told me the world was going to end, I started collecting cans, you know, tinned goods and that sort of stuff for the end of the world. And now I have an entire room full of tin cans. I can no longer go in the room because every time they come out with a new thing that brings the world's going to end, I just have to go and pick up a few more cans. I was actually looking out at, when they came out with this new thing saying the world's going to end in such and such because everything is so much worse than you possibly could have thought. I went just back and I was just like, remember when Tim Flannery was telling us that this whole world was going to end so And so it's actually like 2005 and 2006, he was making predictions that within 5 years, the Arctic's going to be ice-free. And for the people who are younger and don't know who Tim Flannery was, this guy actually ended up being hired by Julia Gillard and the federal government to be climate commissioner. He worked a four-day week for $180,000 a year with free travel, traveling around Australia. But this is the thing, like, if you grew up in the late 90s, early 2000s, you have been hearing this for 15 years. That's how ridiculous it's getting. I mean, most people I know my age have turned it off because even the ones who were really hysterical about it in the first place, you can't be hysterical about the world ending for 15 years.
Yeah,
especially when they keep saying it's going to end in 2 years. It's going to end in 2 years. We only have 1 year. We have 397 days to save the planet. Kevin Rudd, I think, when was the Copenhagen conference? I think it was 2008. That was our last chance to save the planet.
Yes.
That was what they said in the run-up. Yeah, we took some thousands of bureaucrats Rudd, over there.
There's some hilarious Rudd predictions.
But Kevin Rudd was 100% true believer, and mainly for the same reason that most of these people are true believers, because it gives them a purpose in life, to save the world. I mean, who doesn't want to save the world? You get to be the savior of the world. How cool is that? All you have to do is spend gigantic amounts of someone else's money and take out huge loans and debts that'll never be repaid. I mean, what could possibly be easier? It's just, I think this is just, they've slapped the dog so many times that they needed to pick up a stick. It's just not working as much anymore. They're milking the cow as much anymore. They're not getting as much response as what they used to get. China is just more or less openly ignoring them now at this point. And they're not even pretending anymore. It's nobody's going to make the Paris Agreement targets. Even the people who said that they were going to and promised and pinky sweared and all that sort of stuff. There is now a gigantic bureaucracy set up all across the world that is dependent on this. In nearly every university, like people went from, I remember back in the late 90s, they were shutting down earth sciences departments all through Melbourne at La Trobe and all through Sydney and all that sort of stuff. These places were getting shut down because nobody wanted to study any of those things anymore. Then climate change came along, and all of a sudden, instead of being a boring geography lecturer, you are a savior of the world.
That's a really interesting.
You
can
teach your students about how you can save the world.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually, is how it makes things like geography and weather science sexy.
And I mean, see that as like being, I mean, I kind of see it as this development of further or creating new markets, but I agree. Like, I think that they've been doing it for so long that this is like, they've tried to say that the world is ending so many times. People are kind of just neglecting it now. Well, and they're not getting the same financial churn that they used to. And they're just getting so anxious about it.
Well, I think a good, I think a big red pill in this area is the 97% number. It's pretty much like, it's kind of the climate change is equivalent to the gender wage gap theory. So have you guys ever scrutinized the 97% of scientists agree on climate change?
Oh, yeah. No, it's you have to really stretch the definitions.
Yeah, it's so vague.
In order to get that 97%.
No, like people our age don't realize it. Like they think that everyone who questions it is just, you know, must be like a boomer denialist. But it's like, it's just the dumbest. It was literally made by a journalist. But everyone, all the left-wing sources rely on it. Like The Guardian, I'm looking at a piece by The Guardian here called, it's entitled, "There Are Genuine Climate Alarmists, But They're Not in the Same League as Deniers." And so the whole piece is about how, like, yes, maybe we were a little bit, this was published in July of this year. The point of the whole piece is, yes, maybe the left wing has been a bit overzealous in our predictions. And maybe we said that, you know, the outskirts of American cities would be underwater by now. And in 2013, we thought, we wish things were that accelerationist. God, yeah, exactly.
But part of this is why it's so scary, and I'm telling you, particularly from someone who's a little bit older, why it is so scary, and that is the fact that these people have made so many predictions, been so wrong so many times, over and over and over again. They laughably made their predictions far too short in the future, right? So they just kept getting discredited over and over and over again, but they're still winning the argument. They're still the ones who have the sort of the high ground of this. And part of that's that institutional thing that I'm talking about. And part of the institutional thing is the fact that these academics are teaching the new generations of people like you guys, right? The people who are the university students, the people who are going through schools, right? We've now had about, 15 graduating classes of high school who've been taught nothing but orthodox climate theory. So who's, at which point is it going to just be old people who doubt anymore because everyone else has been taught the orthodoxy and been told that everything else is stupid?
Well, that's what's so funny. This piece basically is arguing. So one of the subheadings it's got here, like early on in the piece, unlike deniers, climate alarmists are not influential. Climate deniers are obviously incredibly influential. It just decides.
Oh yeah.
I don't understand. Like it's just the current yearing. Like there's no follow up investigation. That like any causal effect or link between full-on climate deniers and the public understanding of climate change. But anyway, it goes on to admit very late in the piece, but there are some alarmists. That being said, there are a few reasonably well-known individuals who could accurately be described as climate alarmists. The most prominent is Guy McPherson, who decided in 2002 that climate change would likely drive humans to extinction by 2030. And then it goes on, McPherson's case basically boils down to arguing that feedbacks like large methane releases will soon kick in, causing a rapid spike in global warming that will lead to global extinction. One of his primary pieces of supporting evidence is that the Earth system sensitivity, which describes how sensitive the climate is to the increased greenhouse effect over millennia, is higher than the short-term climate sensitivity. That was essentially the gist of a recent study profiled here in The Guardian. So it's like, alarmists aren't influential, but we just take all their talking points and then we write, detailed analysis agreeing with them.
Gosh. So anyway. Like, when's the last time we really had a government that actually actively tried to ignore it? I mean, I think Tony Abbott was kind of against it, but he still had some policies that were about...
Well, exactly. Kind of green stuff. He wasn't right-wing enough on it. Exactly. That's it. He cucked too much.
It's just weird. I don't find it too weird just because I expect it with how finance works. These parties are both funded by, the parties being Labour and Liberal, both funded by the banks. But it just shows, to refute the article further, I suppose, if it's really needed, is that the climate deniers have basically no influence. Even the ones that get elected as prime minister doesn't have enough influence to actually change anything. So...
Yeah, I mean, only in America now can you really get elected as a climate denier. Trump was like a... Trump was like the... Trump said that it was a Chinese conspiracy or something to make... he tweeted that in 2012. Which is good. But anyway, let's move on to our next topic. So in Australian electoral news, I know you guys have strong feelings about this and strong feelings about the Liberal Party. I've become a bit accelerationist about the Liberal Party's downfall, I think. So this kind of excites me. So do you want to take us through it, Lucas?
In Wentworth, a seat which is one of the richest areas in Australia, this electorate has recently been lost by the Liberal Party, which is traditionally the party of the wealthier classes, and they've lost it to a gay former head of the doctors' union who's married to a Jewish lady and said her main priorities are climate change and refugees. And it was over a 20% swing. Against them. And yeah, it's just gigantic. For further context, it was the seat of the former Prime Minister.
Yeah,
Turnbull, for anyone who's not 100% aware, and he ran off. He had just been stabbed in the back by his own party because... He's essentially a centre-left guy trying to lead a nominally centre-right party, and it hadn't really worked out all that well. He got stabbed in the back, and his very, very wealthy constituents were not at all happy about the way in which he departed. And I guess that's a real brief overview of what happened. And because the government and the opposition are so finely balanced, this costs the government their majority, which means hopefully Bob Catter will now get to tell the government what to do.
We can only
hope. Boy, I hope so.
Yeah.
That'd be funny.
So, yeah. So to summarize, yeah, shit's fucked in Australia. Yeah, so I think Lucas might have mentioned, I think you might have mentioned it just then, but yeah, basically the Liberal Party hasn't not held that seat since, I think it was 1944?
Federation.
Really?
They've never lost.
Well, it depends on how you counted this. It depends on how you count that seat.
Yeah, the way that it has is that, like, because, I mean, the Liberal Party hasn't just been the Liberal Party since Federation. It's had the Nationalist Party, it has the Protectionist Party, and then the Commonwealth Liberal Party. They switched positions like 10,000 times. But anyway, technically since Federation, it's always been their seat. It's only gone away from being their seat when the member went independent. But when it came to the election, the independent always lost their seat and lost it to the Liberal Party or whatever equivalent.
And the lesson basically that the media is telling us to learn is that our candidates have to be in future, all of our political candidates have to be more pro climate change sacrificing a goat to the climate gods or whatever those people do. And
I'm sure. Look, I'm sure these people understand that this electorate, which, as I said, is one of the wealthiest electorates in Australia, not just in Sydney, which includes places like Bondi, Port Piper, and all these wonderful places with gigantic mansions with huge fences and guard dogs, and where about 13% of the population is Jewish, and probably double that's gay. The idea that this place is entirely representative of the seats which will decide the next federal election in Western Sydney and suburban Queensland and that sort of stuff, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's absurd. It has absolutely nothing to do with any of that. It's a unicorn. It's an outlier.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that it's such the two parties are so finely balanced. But as you say, from an accelerationist perspective, the Liberal Party has—it's got it coming. It's got it coming big, and it's got it coming hard. And it's not going to be nice when it happens. Much like the Labor Party in the 1950s, there are two distinct constituencies inside the Liberal Party now, and it's very hard to see how they're going to be reconciled.
Yeah. So just to further sort of give context, basically, for the past couple of elections, the Liberal Party has sort of bled votes and been losing face on its right wing, which is traditionally obviously its voting base, and the more right wing people have sort of gravitated towards alternatives like Catter's Australia and One Nation, which are the more right wing populist parties, and so this has sort of led to the Liberal Party's in this weird sort of point where it's proposes itself to be fiscally conservative and socially liberal, I suppose, but even that's not really accurate. So it just has like this weird identity crisis at the moment.
Well, people have always said that it's been a broad church, and it has to a certain extent, but a big chunk of that broad church was the fact that the wealthier constituents were actually willing to put up with the more middle class and even poorer socially conservative ones. The sort of the what usually gets referred to as the base of the Liberal Party, right? And right now, the wealthier and more well off ones, they don't really want to have a bar of the conservative side anymore. They have pretty much it's been a massive sort of class change, and has actually been a class change in Australia's sort of electoral politics, and probably one of the most fundamental ones that's happened in the last 50 years, and that's been the fact that upper class people are now not particularly right wing in any way other than whether or not it takes their money. And sometimes not even then. You're seeing like in Warringah, which is Tony Abbott's electorate, the former prime minister, right next to Malcolm Turnbull's former electorate of Wentworth, the Greens are within 1 point of Labor as of the last election. In this election in Wentworth, the Greens were gained within one percentage point of Labor, right? There are almost as many Greens voters in these wealthy electorates as there are Labor voters, right? Greens are very close to being sort of the unofficial opposition in these richer areas. And that's just because a lot of upper middle class and upper class people, they go through university, they learn all the fashionable ideas, they learn all the orthodoxies, then they get out and they don't really feel like paying all that much in tax, but they keep those same ideas. And maybe they feel a little bit guilty, so they promote climate change or gay marriage a little bit more.
Funnily enough,
to make them feel a little bit better.
Schumpeter, I don't know if you know Schumpeter, but he had a theory on it. And he suggests it's actually because of the welfare of university, where you have all these like intellectual types that come out of university, or, you know, rather people who are educated by these intellectuals, who are frustrated because they often can't find themselves any jobs. And especially when you have these areas who are largely probably rich because of inheritance. They have been the beneficiaries of quite a lot of recent reforms and all sorts of things. Of course, within a democracy, you have to try and cater to these people because you want their votes. But when you have this kind of frustration, I suppose, about not being able to get jobs and all of these different careers that you've been promised through university, you become very much against the system that gave you the education. Being this welfare state, I guess pseudo capitalist thing, I don't know what you would call it. Essentially, they end up rebelling against it in all sorts of ways. And the manifesting thing is that you have rich people in the most ironic act voting for the Greens, who would, if elected, would basically take their money. Like, it doesn't make any consistent sense. However, they identify with the Greens' kind of social policies where they just want to, like, rebel against the structure, even though it actually isn't in their economic interest. And it's just a very strange phenomenon. But Schumpeter talks about it in a far better nuance than me. Yeah, no, it's just an interesting kind of development that we're seeing across the board within the rich areas that would traditionally vote liberal, but now are voting very left-wing.
Well, look, I think you've hit the nail on the head right there with the education thing. You can't discount the higher education system and its effect, that the massive rise in the amount of people going to universities over the course of the last 30 to 40 years has been. And like, I think that what you're talking about with the people coming out with degrees and no particular jobs available or jobs below what they believe they deserve, that more has to do with sort of the upper middle class voting Greens rather than the upper class sort of gravitating to the left. I mean, it's interesting that the upper class people, they went for Karen Phelps in this. They didn't go for the Greens candidate because there's still just that little bit of cut above the arts degree guy who can't get any job other than the one at the local council, and they want to feel a little bit snobbish as well. But it's something that is happening across those sorts of class boundaries, and there really is only one cause, and that is the sort of the massive expansion of higher education system and the ideological orthodoxy that comes through it.
So the woman who won the seat was she, am I right in saying, I mean, I didn't pay that much attention, I just saw this headline quoted, but was she the face of the Yes camp in our same-sex marriage debate?
I think she was a significant part of it. I think she was the director.
I read somewhere she was the face of the Yes camp. I'm like, I've never seen her before. She must.
She was one of the official ambassadors.
Right. Why? As a doctor who is also gay, or what? I don't.
I think she's in the area where like she is in the best position to gather the money out of probably most people, just because she lives in that area. She's clearly networked. She used to work at the Australian Medical Association. She has all of the capacities to create these kinds of organizations. So as it turns out, she becomes the director of the Yes campaign because she herself, being gay, has a personal interest in having same-sex marriage legalized. So alas, she has mobilized her finances and her supporters to achieve it.
She also would have had a big base from her time in the AMA. I mean, that place is
Spleen,
has no shortage of doctors living there.
And it's very worthwhile noting the amount of ridiculous media coverage she got. Like, it was just insane. I reckon the media immediately picked her as the favorite because she got so much attention. There were other independents running, and honestly, probably most people wouldn't even know their names. Why that she got the attention and not the other independents? Who knows? Makes no sense. Literally, who is she? No one really even knew who she was, but suddenly the media has to give her all of the attention, and alas. So I feel like it was a very deliberate thing, especially because like ultimately she's won the seat, but they declared her a winner before the votes were even finished. And then the next day comes along, and it got so close at a point where it was only like the margin was only 0.75%. Like, it's just ridiculous that they were so cocky about how, oh, she's won the seat, fantastic, no worries, everyone can go to sleep and know that, oh, the progressives win again. But, like, it's just, you know, it's just very evident that the media just has, like, a very chauvinistic kind of cockiness about it where they just know, yeah, we always win, we know exactly what we're doing and this is who we are and we dictate to all of you out there in the real world, this is who you're supposed to support, because ignore the other independents, we don't give them any kind of time, we just focus on who we like. So I mean, it's an inside club, and I'm pretty sure anyone who's aware of politics by this point knows that, but it's just, yeah, it's worth noting, I think, because it's probably contributed to her winning quite significantly.
Oh, did you see Fran Kelly, the Radio National presenter, singing a song about how wonderful it was that Phelps won on the ABC on Sunday night?
There's no bias. There's no bias, guys. There's no bias.
She's singing a freaking song. I mean, come on. Look, I know that the ABC guys, they all looked very happy when they were announcing Phelps winning, but looking happy and singing a song, just a little bit of a... Come on, guys. I mean, seriously, you get over $1 billion a year. Can you try?
Oh, jeez.
Well, it's so funny how, like, Turnbull, especially now looking back on it, that he's been knifed and he's just out of there. But the way that, like, Turnbull, when he came in, was so good, was so popular with the media, and the media just really were in his corner against, like, in terms of him taking over from Abbott, and he just thought that it would continue when he got in. And but like now it's like Turnbull's not even left wing enough for them. Like, he's the most left wing liberal leader we'll ever have, God forbid, hopefully. But he was too conservative, quote unquote, for them.
That's the thing, man. You're too young. You forget the first time he ran around when he was opposition leader against Kevin Rudd. The Oscar scandal, the Godwin-Gretsch stuff, I won't go into it. People can say they want, but it was a big scandal that undermined his leadership and got him kicked out by Tony Abbott. Back then, I think it was 2009 or so.
Oh, yeah, right.
He was in the middle of a ABC documentary about how wonderful he was, right, when the Oscar thing went off. And as it all started to fall apart and he realised that he'd been duped, and that everything was looking terrible, he turned around and he realized that the ABC cameras were still there and that they'd been recording the entire time. And just the look on his face when he looked at the cameras, he's just like, you're my friends, aren't you? You're going to help me, aren't you? Please. Just that look in his eyes. And he's just like, he always saw himself as the ABC candidate. That's why he dressed up in a leather jacket and went on Q&A. Right, yeah. That's why he did all that sort of stuff. These are his people. That's why when he put Justin Moon in charge of the ABC, he thought it would solve all his media problems. Right? He has always been of that class. And this is increasingly, I hate to take a Marxist analysis of it, but increasingly this is about class. This is about social class and economic class.
When no, it definitely comes to
things like the Conservatives versus the left in the Liberal Party.
No, totally. Like, in terms of... what I was talking about before in terms of the identity crisis of the Liberal Party, yeah, it very much is a class warfare sort of thing. That these are classes that have been mobilized, I guess, by the, not to get to, you know, Alex Jones posting, but these are social classes that have been mobilized by sort of an elite establishment to agitate against each other, and it's working, and the Liberal Party is just tearing itself to shreds by trying to be half to three quarters of them trying to be loved by the media and trying to be good boys.
Pretty much.
All right, so moving on to the next topic, Lucas, sure. I am actually going to get you to give us the rundown on this one because I know that you've written about it.
We're talking about the Rick and Morty, yes, Rick your... Morton
yes.
article that he wrote in The Australian as social affairs writer for The Australian newspaper. Now, for people who might be unaware, which probably isn't that many, but we'll try, The Australian is usually considered the centerpiece of the News Corp anti-Murdoch conspiracy theory that all left-wingers have, that the only reason that anyone in Australia possibly disagrees with them is because Rupert Murdoch told them to. And it's their answer for why they lose elections. It's their answer for why people don't believe them on things like climate change. The answer for why people suddenly start thinking that gangs of certain ethnicities in Melbourne might not possibly make the best neighbours. It's their answer to absolutely everything. So, but of course, like most things the left believe, it's a pile of crap. They've got Peter Van Onselen, who wrote a piece today about how everyone should shut up and how Turnbull was absolutely wonderful. And they've got Philip Adams, a guy who was originally a member of the Australian Communist Party, the original Stalinist faction, and who now is on the ABC and writes for The Australian. I think he's an editor at large or something along those lines. Paul Kelly, who hasn't been right in 25 years. The Australian is marginally to the right of Australian political opinion, but only marginally. And this is their great big giant death beast. But what Rick decided to write about was a very interesting thing that happened over a month ago. So breaking news, like hot off the presses. He's a sleuth, a news hound. He's managed to track down an event and report on it that happened over a month ago. Well done, Rick. I'm sure you'll get a Walkley. And he, what it was a rally against the Safe Schools program, which was organised by a group called the True Blue Crew, which sort of just a bit of a sort of a street movement analogous to sort of the Proud Boys, you could probably say, except with a distinctly Australian flavour.
Yeah, that's pretty much it as well. Like, I mean,
yeah.
they're trying to paint it like the True Blue Crew is some sort of like actual, like, I don't know, neo-Nazi operation. I mean, I'm sure that a majority of them like Pauline Hanson and that in the left size that qualifies you as a neo-Nazi. But yeah, it's basically the Proud Boys, but the Aussie Bogan version.
Yeah. Well, in his article, he called the True Blue Crew a neo-Nazi rally group. That they were holding an evil neo-Nazi rally.
They're a chapter, actually, because it makes them sound more like the KKK. He literally says the Queensland chapter.
Or a bikie gang.
True Blue Crew. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Fraser Anning, the senator, who is a right-wing senator.
He's my favourite senator.
Yeah, exactly. He's mine too. As soon as he came in, there's just been kvetching all over the place. He's basically just... His maiden speech, he made headlines because he said he called for a plebiscite on immigration. He said that the white Australia policy has served us quite well. And he threw in a reference. He denies that he knew what he was saying, using the phrase final solution, throwing it in there, obviously, to attract headlines.
Yeah. Oh, look, those are the parts you can pull out of it. But I think the whole speech is over a half an hour long. And
it was a great speech. If you actually go into it,
it's fantastic.
Yeah, no, I would recommend people seriously, like, don't that assessment was just, yeah, to get out in front of what you'll read in headlines, not me condemning him. Yeah, no, absolutely, you should listen to the whole speech. It was excellent. It was one of the best speeches I've seen in our parliament in years. And that's my point, yeah. I guess, is just that he just genuinely is willing to say the things that even Pauline won't say now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's, as I said at the time, it was the most incredible speech and incredible maiden speech in Parliament since 20 years ago when Pauline Hanson made her maiden speech and she was the first one to attack him for making it.
The Pauline's reaction to his maiden speech was bizarre. But anyway, so this Rick Morton...
But back to the rally. Yeah, okay, so yeah. for a background, Fraser Anning has left Pauline Hanson's party. He was elected through the various sort of schemes that happened in Australian politics. He ended up becoming a senator and he ended up in the Katter's Australia Party through various convoluted means. So he was making pretty much a speech against the Safe Schools Project, which is a project that was developed mostly at La Trobe University in Victoria with input from a few other places and a few other different education departments. And that project is mostly about normalising, we'll call it alternative sexual orientations amongst young children.
And identities. It's very 72 gender theory is written all over it. I have done a short analysis. I'm just quickly looking it up on my site. Why safe schools is objectionable at the most fundamental levels. If you want just a brief analysis, that was just about a 1,000 sort of word analysis that I wrote. There's much to be said about the Safe Schools program, including that the creator is literally two Marxists from a university.
We'll get to them in a second, but first I need to get back to Rick Morton, this absolute waste of human space that he is. Now, this guy's scribbling for the Australian. Anyway, I'll get into his background in a second. But he basically described the True Blue Crew as Nazis, who they're not. He described Fraser Anning as speaking at a Nazi rally, which he wasn't because they weren't Nazis. Wasn't a single Nazi there. And then he described people attending a libertarian conference nearby, Liberty Fest, as being attached to the True Blue Crew's event because the True Blue Crew advertised it as being like the most exciting thing you'll do whilst you're at this event because they were nearby. And there was some crossover in the crowd. They didn't get as many people to the Safe Schools event as probably they were hoping. I think they only got about 35 or so people. It wasn't the biggest event you could possibly think of. But then they started pulling... Rick started mentioning like every single conservative MP that went to this libertarian conference, right? And the former president of the National Labor Party, Warren Mundine, who's an Aboriginal activist, and starts trying to smear them by association with the neo-Nazi rally because, after all, their names are pretty much coming up in the first couple of paragraphs of his little piece that he did. And the heading is saying Nazi. So that pretty much by guilt by association, all of these people, because Warren Mundine's seen as a bit of a turncoat by members of the left because he's an Aboriginal activist.
He's an Australian Uncle Tom.
Yeah, more or less, yeah. So they definitely like going after him for that, particularly because he was once a Labor Party man as well. And this just really, really sticks in my craw because this was covered at the time. This event, it wasn't a big event, so it wasn't covered widely, but it was covered in local media and by other people online at the time. Not a single person said anything about neo-Nazism because there was nothing about neo-Nazism to say. But he comes along a month later and suddenly decides that this was a Nazi rally. He comes along a month later and suddenly decides that he's going to attack Fraser Anning, a man he never really seems to have mentioned before looking at his back catalogue. It's absolutely crystal clear that he's been handed a press release by somebody, and this is happening in the same week that Fraser Anning is receiving pressure from inside the Katter Australia Party to tone down his immigration views and to stop talking about immigration as much, and actually had a meeting recently about whether or not to disendorse him. There's one guy inside the Katter Australia Party, I forget his name, he's Shane something, who has been particularly behind this push. Right, to get rid of Fraser because he's icky and nasty and right wing. Oh, sorry, man. It's in an Australian article.
I'll find it. Unfortunately.
it's reading between the lines. This is such an obvious hit job that this guy's allowing himself to be used in. And the more you look into like Rick Morton, the more you find a hate about this guy. I mean, he has recently just been nominated for a Walkley, right, for a book that he wrote. This book. It's like 100 Years of Dirt, or something along those lines, right? Completely trashes his own family, right? Going back two generations, right? His family are cattle station owners, right, from Queensland, and he is the little cosmopolitan grandson of his grandfather who built up this business.
Just the name of it reeks of just the...
It's so condescending.
Oh, man. Just looking at the front page of the book, I feel sick.
Everything about it is about how his mum was driven to drug addiction by his evil, violent, cheating father, about how his brother was trapped in farm machinery or something along the lines and ended up having half his skin burnt off, about how his grandfather was a tyrant who tortured his father, and he's laying out all this dirty laundry, which may or may not be true. I'm looking at him, I really wouldn't trust him to say anything at all. Right? He's laying out his family's entire mental scars out for everyone to see in the entire world. He's got all his friends in the media to promote this book. Right, it's been promoted by the Sydney Morning Herald. It's been promoted by other Fairfax titles. It's been promoted by News Corp. It's been reviewed favourably in The Australian, of course, the paper that he writes for. It's been reviewed favourably by the ABC. Right, he has pimped this book out absolutely everywhere. And he's even managed to get it nominated for one of the highest literary prizes in Australia. And the entire book is shitting on his own family.
Well, but look at his Facebook. Go on his Twitter. Look at his fucking profile picture. He's like the most soy boy cuck I've ever seen.
He's around and look up more pictures of him. Every one is worse than the last. Right? The man is just a gigantic, walking, sort of bulging, misshapen form of mutation that this isn't even human. He's not human shaped.
He's got
his face isn't human shaped.
He's one of those people that tweets just constantly. Like if you go on his Twitter, you scroll down like 20 tweets, you're only at like 5 hours ago. But he's got like, so I'm looking at just for the last couple of hours. So he's got, cannot wait until the heat death of the universe. Oh, deep, real deep, Rick. Fuck yeah.
How edgy.
Epic. And then he's got later on, 2 hours ago, in square brackets, whispers, nothing will ever make you happy. So sad.
He's just so edgy. Man.
Here you've got this guy, okay, he's from outback Queensland originally. His family had to move to the city. They grew up a little bit rough. And now he's managed to climb his way up, get himself up into journalism, managed to get up, and he's friends of all these people. You see, he always retweets nice things that other journalists say about him, right? Things from prominent ABC people, from Fairfax people, from all that sort of stuff, about how much they liked his book, about how it was a ripping read, about all this sorts of stuff. And you're just like, you are crucifying your own family for social status.
I wouldn't, because you're wouldn't not going to make care. That much
money off a book. But
I wouldn't even care, except for the fact that this is written in The Australian, and that is just really stupid to me. And it's just, I don't know why.
Yeah, because we all sort of internalize a bit of the left wing thing, where The Australian is the evil right wing newspaper. But like, I can't read it because it's not.
Well, I can't. I could have really until, I mean, I know that there's this kind of thing breaks through every now and then, but I mean, this is just the final straw, really. Like, if this is their, well, I mean, what even is a social affairs writer for one? Why do they even have a social affairs writer? But two,
To write from the interests of marginalized communities.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, so is how he puts it.
So a left-wing writer.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's just, oh, and the main part that really just gets me, and it got me before when other journalists were doing it, okay, when other journalists were reporting on the evil neo-Nazi rally that happened, right, because they don't want to teach young boys that they should mutilate themselves. The thing that happened, other journalists, of course, they missed the fact that the counter-protesters were all left-wing extremists. And I wrote about this at the time, because there is a habit amongst sort of journalists in Australia that it doesn't matter if you show up waving an anarchist flag and throwing Molotov cocktails around, they'll call you a protester or an anti-racist or an interested party or someone who's opposed. They'll never point out your violence. They'll never point out your extremist views. But the people who were there that day, there was about probably a dozen of them who were protesting against the protest that was against the Safe Schools rally. They were from, as we pointed out on the Unshackled before, was Kathleen McLeod, right, who's a local anarchist organiser. A few of her buddies were there as well, all dressed in their black masks. And another group that only saw when it's looking over a lot of the footage and that sort of stuff that was there, because there's only a couple of them there, was from the Workers League group, which I thought was a myth. I'd never actually seen them come out to any rallies before, because they're outright Stalinists. They're anti-revisionists in their view. They want to sort of recoup the heritage of Mao and Stalin. Right? So on one side, you've got people who are barracking for Mao, Stalin, and anarchy. On the other side, you've got people waving Australian flags saying, please don't brainwash our kids. And Rick sits down at his computer and decides that the latter group are evil extremists and that they need to be punished. And that they need
I mean, I feel like this is just stuff. Like, it's practically just common now. Like, it's like, as far as it's like the right is concerned, like anyone who's actually genuinely on the right, it's like it's just expected almost that any kind of actual extremism from the left, I suppose, is just ignored, and that the right, who is only marginally right wing, is considered to be extremist. But that's just that shift of the Overton window, I suppose.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's like that whole thing where, you know, if you went back decades, there weren't people covering their faces until there was the left wing whole Antifa cover your face thing.
Well, with the left in Australia, it started from the anti-globalisation protests in the late 90s and the early 2000s. That's when the anarchists really sort of got a bit of a boot up and they started bringing that culture. Mm. They did it a little bit before that, but it wasn't really widespread.
Right.
And, yeah, you guys know about the anti-mask law that they've got in Victoria?
Yeah, yeah.
You know how that came about?
No, do tell.
Pretty much the left had been wearing, as I said, they'd been wearing masks to protest and attacking people with impunity for about a good 15 years now. And it was only when right-wingers started wearing those Australian flag masks that you're talking about that all of a sudden it was a huge problem and now we need to ban masks.
Yeah, of course. Oh, no. Is this nationalism?
Yeah. Look,
no,
it's
one,
the...
anarchism. No, the same sort of thing with...
It's the same sort of thing that people say, oh, don't... We need to keep the moral high ground. We can't fight back or do anything like that. The Andrew Bolt.
We just need to get punched. Right. Just let two skeevy teenagers punch you on the street at your own book launch.
I'm at this point, I feel like it's just like I always call it conservative cowardice because I feel like there's just this strain of old conservatism. I guess you could call it now conservatism of the last 70 years. That have just completely failed due to their utter cowardice in the face of danger. They are not willing to do anything unless it's just going to be done behind a desk somewhere in some room or at a dinner table. Like I don't know if you guys have been in the Liberal Party, but all they do is just have dinner after dinner after dinner, just saying, oh, we're really going to get out there and fight those lefties today when we, you know, think of good ideas. And then they just sit there and then eat and just listen to people talk.
And just be rich.
Yeah, and then they just literally rub each other's back. Oh, we really, you know, we might have lost that election for the 500th time, but you know what? We really did well this time. We may have just decreased the margin and lost it even further, but yeah, we did really good. We really bring in the fight. We got like a tax reform passed. Yeah. Well, meanwhile, the left are like laughing because they're literally teaching kids to touch themselves at the age of 3. Like, come on. Like, it's just insane. Yeah, but you say these people and they're like, oh no, but you're being immoral, you can't do that, that's stooping down to their level. Like, come on.
Look, the thing is that the only reason that masks got banned in Victoria, and a couple of anarchists have actually got hauled up on it already, the only reason masks got banned in Victoria was because right wingers put on masks. The only way that left wing street violence is going to stop is when right wingers stand up to them. That doesn't mean necessarily no advocation of going out and attacking anybody if anybody is listening. All right, this is just saying that...
Just get attacked first and make it their last attack.
Yeah, unless people actually stand up for themselves, okay, it's not going to happen. Getting beaten up only works when you have a sympathetic media. All right, Mahatma Gandhi understood that. That's why he kept getting beaten up. All right, Mahatma Gandhi, Churchill picked him from the first time he even heard of him. Right, Mahatma Gandhi was a sneaky little prick, and that's why he won, okay? Because he was a sneaky little prick. He knew exactly what he could get away with the British and what he couldn't, and what would tug on the heartstrings and what wouldn't. He intimately understood British culture and the ideas of fair play behind it and that sort of stuff, and he knew how to exploit it, all right? Pretending that you're Mahatma Gandhi when you're facing the modern left who literally think you are Nazis, who deserve to have your skull smashed in, and that the only reason they don't do it is because of their own virtue, that's pretty much the way they view it, right? They're all right-wingers are scum who don't even deserve life, and that the only reason they don't hit you is because they're virtuous. that's how they view the world. So when people do go out and start hitting right wingers, they say, oh, well, maybe that was just a moment of weakness. They did deserve it after all.
I wonder how many neo-Nazis Rick Morton thinks there are walking the streets on Australia Day, being wrapped in those Australian
Bro,
flags.
Bro, our country is ran by Nazis, if you didn't realize. When you go to school and you go through that system, all they just have is Hail Hitler every 5 minutes.
Yeah, they have. They even have the flag hanging in some places.
Yeah, they've got the Australian flag. Oh, if you, like, disgusting. Shape it correctly, it kind of looks like a swastika. You just got to get a couple more flags and wrap it the right way. But eventually, you get the swastika and that's bad.
But Daniel, like you were talking about, these people inside the Liberal Party, they just don't actually seem to get it. I mean, it pulls back to the Andrew Bolt again. He got smashed in the face in the middle of the street in front of a book launch. Right? His only real thing was to say, oh, look, what is it with the left and violence? And
so much for the tolerant left.
It's like so much for the tolerant left as they try and smash your skull in and get away with it. Victoria Police shut down their actual investigation, their undercover investigations into extreme left-wing groups. I don't know if they've restarted it, but they officially shut them down in roughly about 2005, 2006 because they got caught infiltrating Socialist Alternative. And all the local church groups and all the local peace activist groups all got mobilised by the Socialist Alternative people, and they all complained to Fairfax. Fairfax ran a campaign. Victoria Police actually ended up abolishing the undercover unit they were using to people spot. That's why when the Milo event came around just the other year, they had no intelligence. They had no idea who these people were. They had no idea who was doing any organising. They had no idea of the groups behind it. They'd essentially completely ignored the extreme left in Australia for a course of 10 years when they've been undergoing rapid growth. It's just absolutely astonishing.
Just before we move on to from Australian news to US news, this is going a bit under the radar. I just wanted to quickly mention this. I mean, the story is basically over now. It won't go anywhere, but... on the 13th of October, Sky News was reporting that an ethics committee was investigating the Queensland Premier, Anastasia Palaszczuk. Is that how you pronounce it, Lucas?
Who knows, honestly?
She's your Premier. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, she was being investigated. And this sort of reiterates, I guess, what I was saying before about the establishment kvetching over how dare... someone like Senator Anning make it into the halls of our parliament. So the Queensland Premier had previously sought to punish them. I'm not even sure why state has any bearing on this, and in terms of her ability to cut staff from Katter's party, but basically
because Katter's party has state representatives. Katter's party has state representatives, and so they were given, and normally with the amount of representatives they had, you're only like eligible to get so many paid staffers, but it's within the gift of the Premier to give, I think it's an extra 6 places or something like that.
Right,
so it's a considerable staffing boost for a small party. Now she gave those to Katter in exchange for his help in a hung parliament at some point, getting his vote across the line. It was essentially a gigantic bribe. Would have been worth probably, if you're looking across a couple of years, might even be over $1 million. And so she essentially removed those because they refused Robbie Katter, Bob Katter's son, who sits in the state parliament. He and others refused to condemn Fraser Anning when the Labor Party put up a motion condemning Fraser Anning. So that was their get back at them. Now, the thing is, that is technically blackmail under the law as it stands. So it's like it's demanding political votes for and saying that you're going to take away money or take away gifts if you don't get them. So it is technically corruption. But I believe that they needed to actually pass a vote to start a prosecution.
Yeah, so that's where the Labor
Party is in charge, never happened.
Yeah, that's where it's fallen down. So, yeah, so that was on the 13th of October, and there was calls for her to stand down, and it was all a very developing, exciting situation then. I was thinking, oh, my God, something might actually happen here. But no, of course, the Queensland State Labor Government used its numbers in their state parliament to prevent a committee being set up to even investigate the Premier.
I just hate this system so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Ethics Committee even found that she technically broke the law
This,
so that's why it's just so shocking.
Why when did we ever give the politicians the power defy it? Just like, we didn't like that part, so we're having a vote and we're saying it's not happening.
Later on in the article, she goes, there's a quote here from her, sorry. Just go back through the history. I'm sure there's plenty who have been, as in premiers, who have been referred to the Ethics Committee. I'm probably in good company, she said. All right, so moving on to USA news. So Kanye West visited the White House. I'm sure you guys heard.
So yeah, the American media had a huge meltdown over this. It was the clip for the audience. It was the clip that we played at the start. Did you guys get a chance to see the clip?
The MSNBC one, would that be the one where they're saying we want to trade Kanye in the racial draft? He can be white now.
No, that's not in that clip, actually. Don Lemon seemed the most offended. Don Lemon especially.
Well, he's a gay black man.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just start off and say that, yeah, it's fair to say from those clips that the media was not entirely happy with Kanye going. Don't think they were particularly pleased with it. And I know that I've heard from some other places that the general idea is that it might spur some black approval rating of Donald Trump, which, strangely enough, amongst black males, isn't actually doing that bad.
Yeah, well, he already...
surprised a lot of people.
He already has, like, drastically improved that particular demographic's approval ratings, which makes sense when you look at the jobs that he's providing them.
That's a bit of don't give a fuck.
Trump always had a lot of positive cultural clout. He was seen by a lot of the African-American community as like an aspiration of wealth.
You ever heard the track Donald Trump Walk?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's an example. That's the kind of thing I was looking for. Yeah, exactly.
No, man, that's pretty good. Yeah, he's had more references in hip hop tracks than probably any other white guy. Mainly because he's been around for 30 odd years in the business around the same time that hip hop was developing. So these hip hop guys going, I want to be rich. Who do I want to be rich by? Like, I want to be rich like
Donald Trump. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Yeah. He was an aspiration of wealth of absurd wealth, yeah, which is interesting. It was only
and
once...
flashy,
yeah,
ostentatious wealth.
And, like, hedonism, yeah. It's only once he became a political candidate that the left was able to mobilize black people against him. It was only once he started the anti-immigrant sentiment, but... With the economy going the way it is, even African Americans are starting to wake up to the fact that he's not the monster that he was portrayed to be. All right, so moving to the next piece of US news, Elizabeth Warren has come out triumphantly to prove that she's less Native American than the average US citizen. This was only a talking point because I don't know why she's waited this long to actually get the test done, but it was a good year, maybe more than a year ago now, that Trump was mocking her yet again for calling her Pocahontas because she pretended in the, I think it was 2012 or 2013, it became an issue that she claimed to be Native American because her papaw had the high cheekbones.
Warren says her great-great-great-grandmother is Cherokee, but genealogists have yet to confirm that. Warren referenced a photo of her grandfather on her mantle as part of the family lore.
My Aunt B has walked by that picture at least 1,000 times, remarked that her father, my papa, had high cheekbones like all of the Indians do, because that's how she saw it. And she said, and your mother got those same great cheekbones, and I didn't. She thought this was the bad deal she had gotten in life.
So she's gone and taken the DNA test because Trump had promised that if she could prove her Native American ancestry, he would donate, I think it was $1 million, to a charity of her choice. So Elizabeth Warren released the results of this test, which have shown that she has potentially 1/1024th Native American heritage, somewhere between 6 to 10 generations back. And that means that she's potentially 0.098%, and at best she's 3% Native American, and the average European American has 0.18% Native American heritage. So she may even be less, this is according to a study by the Genetic Literacy Project. So it may even be the case that she's even less Native American than a random guy that you pulled off the street in America.
Ah, so funny.
She's claiming this as a win is just the hilarious part.
They're just grabbing for as much as they can. Where they just these people just really need to be told to shut up and hopefully slapped in the face.
Yeah, well, the Cherokee Nation's telling her to shut up. So
good.
The Cherokee
God,
Nation.
God, I wish. I wish that the Aboriginal elder groups in Australia had the same sort of attitude.
Yeah,
the Cherokee.
Yeah, I reckon. Totally. No, I completely agree.
If they just, hey man, look, sorry for the wide Aboriginal audience that's out there listening to this. Please get a hold of your people. I'm sure there's a huge amount. But please get a hold of your people.
It's just purely Aboriginal.
Look, man, the fact when they show up with, when you get people who are like red hair and blue eyes and lots of freckles and they're so white that they're practically see-through, and they're walking around with all that white paint on and they got the, you know, trying to do a traditional dance and they're falling over themselves. I mean, please, come on, man. That's got to embarrass you just as much as it does white people. Please stop them.
So moving on to European news, our good friend Salvini, who we were talking about on the show last week, is claiming that the French radical centrist president Emmanuel Macron has been taking in migrants and dropping them off in north of Italy in some remote Italian woods for the Italian authorities to discover.
Oh, Emmanuel Macron. Gosh. He's like, I'm sorry, like, as much as I should hate him because he's literally the manifest of everything I should hate, he's like a neoliberal centrist like banker. He's just so funny because he's just so cocky about himself. And like, it just seems like such a thing that he would do. Like, I don't want these immigrants. North Italy can have them.
Yeah, well, I was like, yeah, the dichotomy is like, left-wing cuck EU state takes in like millions of migrants, you know, based right-wing non-cucks, like Eastern European states take no migrants. And then there's the radical centrist France, like take in a million migrants, but dump like half of them on the other member states.
Oh my gosh. It's just like, it just seems to be this guy. I think he's like sniping for Merkel's position in the EU, because he's just constantly pushing France further than it ever wanted to go. And it's just, it seems like he's just got such a cocky attitude where he will do this stuff, even if it's controversial, he honestly doesn't care. Like, he started off by saying that there's civilizational issues with Africa, and everyone on the left just went insane because he's like, this guy's, you know, a racist. But then, like, on the opposite side, he's doing, like, this weird stuff. It's just, like, this guy, I think, he deliberately tries to make himself hard to read, but he's obviously definitely neoliberal. That's just hilarious, though. It's just so Emmanuel Macron, this cocky guy that just wants to rule the world. He wants to be the next Napoleon, probably.
Yeah, what did he say? He was like,
well, all right. Well, Daniel is clearly on team Macron there.
Are you counter-signaling?
I mean, I hate him, but he's just hilarious.
No, mate. You're like the girl saying that she really, really hates the guy with the big muscles who's such a bully.
Pretty much.
He, when he was coming in,
Team Salvini, fuck that Macron bastard.
When Emmanuel Macron was coming in, I remember him saying there being a quote. He said something like he wanted to have a Jupiterian rule.
Yes,
what the fuck that means.
A Jupiterian rule, and like. And he got it. Like, he had his presidential, like, inauguration or whatever in the Palace of Versailles, which usually they don't have it there. Like, like he literally like models himself as like some kind of Napoleonic figure of the Republic, where he's just come in and is like, ah, yes, look at me, Macron, come in, and now I am president. And he stole like the elections for the. For the parliament, it's almost like none of the other parties bothered. He got a supermajority. Like, it's just ridiculous. And, I mean, no one likes him now, but that doesn't matter. When the elections come around, he's a schmoozer. He will get everyone to vote for him again. I don't know if, I can almost guarantee that.
So the French police
one likes him now, but Daniel, you sound almost in love. You got a bit of a crush.
Look... He's a very handsome individual. I won't deny it. And look, let's be honest. He might be dating like this really old witch. However,
yeah, let's not talk about his wife.
Fine. But she is part of a family of people who create macarons, and I think there's a link there.
Because, is that actually true?
I think you might.
Yes.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, I heard something about that.
So because of that, obviously, his name being Macron. Very, very necessary for his subsistence that he has very easy access to macarons.
Apparently, the French authorities...
Yeah, it's almost like a glitch in the system there. It's like a glitch in the simulation. It's like, hey, wait a second. This isn't real.
The French authorities apparently defended themselves by claiming that this was a mistake. I think they're saying there's some confusion as to the border or something.
I'm sorry, we thought we were in France.
We thought we were just dropping off the immigrants in the middle of a forest in France. What's the problem? They can survive for themselves.
We saw the winery, we saw many immigrants already, we just put them in there.
Christ. Alright, let's move on to our last story for the night. We need to wrap this up. So Theresa May's quote unquote conservative party currently in charge of Britain is getting cold feet on Brexit. And Boris Johnson has been urging his fellow Brexiteers to prepare to quote resist a deal that leaves Britain as a colony of the EU.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys' takes on this? I assume we're all very pro-Brexit.
I absolutely despise the EU, and honestly, the amount of joy that I had, I mean, it had nothing to do with the fact that I bet quite a bit of money on the UK leaving, but the joy of, like, genuine joy where I was, like, ready to just blast, like, British patriotic songs because I was just like, finally, there's, like, significant change. And then since then, I've been absolutely bitterly disappointed because the British government has been filibustering like there's no tomorrow with these just ridiculous negotiations that have been pathetic. And then interestingly, there was a poll done amongst Germans, and they said, should there be an easy agreement? Should there be like, I don't remember the exact terms, was like whether the agreement with the UK should be positive or assist them. And the German public vehemently seem to despise the UK because 80% said that no, we should be tough on Britain. So Merkel definitely has all the support that she needs from her local from her local bases to go out and tell the UK that sorry, you have to give us all this money and all this sorts of just random stuff that they keep demanding from them in order to have them leave, which is just ridiculous because I don't know. It's just, you think that once a nation wants to part ways with an organization internationally, you would think that their sovereignty should triumph. But of course, anyone who really looks into this knows that sovereignty is a very questionable thing nowadays. Whether countries have it or not is not really, you know, it's a question to be asked. And in this case, evidently, it seems that in order to remove yourself from a European Union requires spending lots and lots and lots of money and keeping yourself enslaved to the various EU systems and the trade agreements that you have to make, which clearly benefits the continent. It's just really depressing, particularly just looking at how Brexit has really almost become a complete failure, at least in the sense that it was supposed to achieve a better Britain. It's really damaging it, unfortunately.
I'm wondering if the UK I don't know much about the UK Tories, but I'm wondering if their situation is similar to what we've sort of been talking about earlier with the whole Liberal Party in terms of an identity crisis, because they almost ended up in a leadership spill earlier this week over this issue as well. There was 40 out of the 48 letters needed from Tory MPs to trigger a vote of confidence in leadership.
If you look at back through the European Union, if you look back with the Conservative Party, the Tory Party's relationship with the EU going back even back to the 70s and the 80s, it was always a major split in the party, like a huge, like gigantic divide down the center of the party. It ended up destroying John Major, arguably, right? Even though Maggie Thatcher had been in for ages. Thatcher was fighting battles on it the entire time she was in power. The years in the wilderness with Tony Blair around, there used to be, like, it was immigration and Europe. Every single time you had a split between the more right-wing people in the Tory Party and the more left people who considered themselves to be nice and modern, wonderful, and yeah, you can start to see the similarities of Australia immediately.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening, like, I was with you, Daniel, seriously, like, when I saw the Brexit results, because this was before Trump. So when I saw the Brexit results, and I'd been following it fairly closely, being news, and just seeing those come in and seeing the looks on the BBC presenters' faces as the results started to come in, seeing the looks on the Channel 4 and ITV people's faces, seeing the looks on them, and like even the Australian ones, the ABC presenters who were covering it, they were in shock. They were devastated. It was wonderful. It was the best thing until Trump. I never been much of a British patriot, but ended up blasting God Save the Queen out in the car.
Yes.
And it was just absolutely just such a ringing thing that the people who were in charge, because everyone in charge, every single powerful power group, every single power broker in the UK was against Brexit. The financial sector in the City of London, which, you know, Daniel, you know a bit about finance, you know just how powerful that is in British politics. It's pretty much like God itself.
Yeah.
The City of London. Financial strength, and the FTSE and that sort of stuff. It is like, it can make and break governments. And they were wholeheartedly against it. They warned that the entire country would collapse, even if the vote had just gone to yes. The universities were against it. Nearly every single newspaper was against it. All of the television stations were against it. All of the celebrities were against it. Half the Tory party was against it. All of the Labour Party was against it. The Lib Dems were against it. The Greens were against it. Nearly everyone who had any power whatsoever in the UK was against it. And it still happened. And it was just one of the most beautiful and amazing things that's ever happened. And people wonder why it's with all those people against it and still against it. They still are. Right? Why it hasn't been a smooth transition. I mean, come on, aside from a few opportunists like Boris Johnson who jumping around like the clown that he is, nobody even wants to try and argue for an independent Britain because they were all so emotionally invested in staying in the EU. I can't understand it as an outsider why the huge emotional investment from middle and upper class people, and it is, you look at the voting pattern of Brexit, was middle and upper class people and people from London. That was it. Those were the groups that voted against Brexit.
What I love
the working class people.
Yeah, that's what I love. That it was just that there's
there was this big expectation because Labour just like, oh yeah, you know, we're always going to get the vote from the working class. But it was the working class that tipped it. It was the working class that voted, nah, we're leaving. And no one could understand it. Like no one in the media, like they were just, their minds were like blown. The fact that they're such a loyal base just left them. Oh, so sad. Because the thing is, and obviously, that Labour Party is.
When they came back, It was almost as funny when they came back the next election. And all the Tories assumed that because all these people up in Sunderland, up in the north, had voted for Brexit, that means that they were going to be Tory voters or UKIP voters from now on. Yeah. And they immediately went back and voted for Labour again, and Jeremy Corbyn almost became Prime Minister.
Oh, man, Corbyn is such an interesting case.
Corbyn is an interesting case, I agree.
There's people on the left and the right in the UK, much like a lot of the left and the right here in Australia, they seem to have no frigging clue what working class people actually think.
Crazy how it's like
from past voting patterns and that sort of stuff. This wasn't the case back in the 60s and the 70s. The Labour Party guys in Australia and in Britain back in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, they were one generation removed at most from actually being working class, from a factory floor, from a workshop. I mean, in Australia, our last actual working class prime minister was Ben Chifley. But even then, it was like, you were the sons of the working class. Right? You were the sons of the guys who came from the factory floor, or at worst, the foreman. So you actually grew up in that neighbourhood and you knew people. But these people are now so far removed, both in Britain and in Australia. They haven't got the faintest clue what's going on. It's kind of funny when it backfires on them.
Mm.
Yeah, for Brexit, they're going to get a hard Brexit. It's going to happen. There's no way that a deal is going to get done. I think Boris and those 40 will undermine anything, and that's my prediction.
Yeah, well, I hope that they do. I mean, it is quite that, and I mean, you bring up the point about how the entire—I mean, similar to sort of Trump v. Hillary—the entire establishment was on the one side, and the people chose the other side. And it is crazy when you think about the degrees of investment, the degrees of resources that are mobilized on the one side, and yet enough people still break through to the other side, and it's just enough people break through that to let the other side win, and it just shows you where the real emotion lies and where the manufactured marketed emotion lies, and the fact that people are trying to the fact that people like May are now trying to delegitimize to a degree Brexit and go, oh well, maybe we can just do a soft Brexit.
Yeah, it's just, it's gone, this is the thing. I mean, I always recommend everyone to read this book, and it's called The Crowd by Gustave Le Bon. He talks about how crowds think, the way that crowds act, and the way that crowds are controlled, essentially, in a very, like, objective kind of psychological kind of point of view. And, like, It doesn't become surprising how these people are like, they have these like shifts where they will vote a certain way against something and it's just radical, but then they come back to how they were just beforehand. And it's like, I think it's one of the things that really pushes it is this economic hardship that's developing over time as inflation starts to outpace, workers' wages. And they can't afford as much as they used to. All this kind of stuff has a element where when they're being told one thing from the media, but then they feel something else in their back pocket, they realize everything's not quite linking up how they used to know back in the old days. But it's very hard for them to really get out of that mindset until finally someone actually takes all of their money off of them, whether it be like a Great Depression or something. So they just switch back to how they were beforehand. And I mean, I think Brexit was probably the most miraculous thing because at least Trump had the Republican Party, where Brexit had not even half the Conservative Party.
What's his name? Nigel Farage.
Yes.
That's virtually how I remember Brexit, was just him being the pro-Brexit side.
Mr. Brexit.
And maybe Boris as his little, like, I don't know what you'd say. His henchman. But he's his man on the inside. But yeah, it was pretty much Farage. He's got a show called Farage Against the Machine, which is fucking absolutely perfect because that's exactly what it is. It's just him trying to be a pro, you know, English nationalist guy against this gigantic, disgusting EU establishment.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, I think we might leave it there. We've been going on long enough.
Yeah.
So we hope you've enjoyed episode 2 of the Pop and Lock Report. Check out popandlock.net for more analysis and commentary from us. We also have an Australian history podcast, so if you subscribe to us, you can look out for that. Thank you to The Unshackled for letting us use their platform, and check out their coverage at theunshackled.net. Thanks for tuning in. Take care of each other, and we'll see you guys next week.